if we're there for our children 100% of the time, we're doing them a disservice.
Welcome to the Book Society podcast, where we talk to interesting people about interesting books. It's really that simple. Okay, here we go. Welcome to the Book Society podcast. I'm Lucas Cantor Santiago, your host. Today, we're talking with Professor Dr. Katie Davis. Her friends and her podcast hosts get to call her Katie. She is an associate professor at the University of Washington and the director for the University of Washington Digital Youth Lab. She holds two master's degrees and a PhD in human development from Harvard. She has contributed to or been the main author of 70 publications, which include three books, The App Generation, Writers in the Secret Garden, and the book we're going to talk about today, Technology's Child, which is a release from MIT Press this year. And I have an advanced copy, but is it out?
It's out now. Yeah, it was out starting March 7th.
Okay, so it came out March 7th, 2023. I can highly recommend that you pick up a copy. It is fantastic. And this episode is going to be a little bit different. I'm going to give you a little preamble about myself and my kids and my philosophy towards my kids, and then we're going to tie that into your book. I would imagine this is not the first time this has happened to you, but we're going to do it anyway. So listeners all know that I have kids. I have two children, Jude and Coltrane. They're 2 years old, 4 years old, both boys. And we do our best not to use our phones in front of them, and we don't let them use the phones. We've just started introducing a very minimal amount of screen time, although we do let them watch baseball whenever they want. Whenever there's a Dodger game on, we'll watch baseball.
Good to have your priorities.
Yeah. The first thing that they ever saw on television was the Dodgers winning the World Series. And the second thing they saw was Joe Biden getting inaugurated. And other than that, it's just baseball. And we started watching one cartoon recently that was recommended by a friend. And so, but yeah, we keep our phones away from them. And when I'm in a restaurant, they're usually very behaved. We go to restaurants. And usually when I'm in a restaurant that's kid friendly, I'll look around at the tables and I see most of the kids are playing with tablets or doing something, you know, on some virtual screen while their parents are talking. And every time I see that, I get this little jolt of superiority. Is that right for me to be feeling that? Or are there ways that kids can be interacting with apps at the table that are healthy and good for them?
Well, you know, so I have to say I have had that experience as well when I see kids on tablets or phones at a restaurant, because I'm pretty strict with my son about that. However, I think you need to also think about there might be a broader context surrounding that particular instance of that child in that restaurant on a tablet. So maybe they've been really busy all day. They've been out and engaged, highly engaged with their parents, and their parents just need 15 minutes to just be able to talk with each other. You know, that could be one context. On the flip side of that, you could have parents who are just always ready to give their kids tablets just so that they, you know, if their kids are complaining because they're bored or they just don't want to be bothered talking with them at a restaurant, you could have that as well. So it's really hard to know what you're dealing with if you just take a look at the child on the tablet, because you don't know that backstory. You don't know the surrounding context. And as you kind of allude to, you don't also know what it is they're interacting with. And, you know, their screen time is not created equal. And that's something that I really focus on in the book, is that just by looking at a child who is looking at a screen, you don't necessarily know what it is they're getting out of it, what's the content, what are the possibilities for their learning, and things like that. So it's probably a little bit more complicated than just looking at them and saying, oh, I'm doing it better. Although I think, you know, if you can avoid it as much as possible, I think that's probably in your child's or your children's best interest.
So that is a very soft way of saying, you know, I mean, it sounds like you're saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, that limiting child, especially young child screen time, is a very good thing to do. And you are not just a mom saying that, you are a expert and a doctor in this field.
Yeah. And so there are many reasons why, especially when we're talking about young children, why I think it's good to limit their engagement with various kinds of screens. First of all, before the age of about two or three, they're not really getting much out of looking at a screen. It's really hard for really young kids to be able to translate something that they see in 2D into the 3D world. It actually takes quite a lot of cognitive processes to do that. So the learning potential for really young kids is just very limited. And if you think about the way little kids learn best, they learn best when they have someone by their side who really knows them and can engage with them and respond to them and provide just the right support for them based on everything they know about their personality and their interests. And it's very difficult for screens can be interactive, but they aren't often socially contingent, which means that you actually know the person that you're interacting with and what they like and what gets them excited. So in that sense, yes, I think limiting for screen time for little kids is probably the way to go. However, you know, there are many different exceptions. So for me, when my son Oliver, he's six now, but when he was really little, we did a lot of traveling. We lived in Berlin for 4 years of his life, and we were visiting our family and taking lots of plane rides. And I would say that in that context of a plane ride and long layovers, you know, it's absolutely fine to get into survival mode and put the screen on and just let them watch whatever it is within reason, as long as you're paying attention to the content. But yeah, so, and then there are definitely apps that are more educational. And in the book, I talk about, you know, what makes an app, and if we're really just focusing on little kids right now, what makes a particular app more or less developmentally supportive? And one thing that I argue is that what you wanted to do is look to see if your child can really control what's going on and set the pace and really direct their actions. And you want to be on the lookout for what they call in design dark patterns. So these features that developers specifically use in order to co-opt our attention and keep us on platform. So in the context of children's technology use, these would be features like virtual characters in a game who cry when you exit. You know, that's sort of a pretty manipulative way to get a kid to keep staying on the platform and keep engaged. Another example might be, you know, your typical virtual rewards, or even just, you know, countdown clocks, or making it difficult to find the home screen, because then it's, you know, you're more likely to stay engaged. So you want to look out for these dark patterns and pay close attention to how the app experience has been designed. And if you can see evidence where your child has room to kind of put their stamp on it, you know, I think painting apps or drawing apps, coloring apps are great examples of, generally speaking, app experiences where children get to, you know, show a little bit of creativity. They get to direct the experience. They're pretty much minimal dark patterns in those kinds of apps. So yeah, you want to get, you know, the first level would be try to minimize. The second level is try to look deeply at what sort of experience this app is providing your child.
So, you know, in your answer and in your book, I noticed this, I don't know how to phrase this, but I noticed this interesting assumption, maybe, that it is sometimes necessary to hand an interactive screen to a child, but it just isn't. I mean, these didn't exist 15 years ago. And, you know, like, why can't we just never give a child an app to use? Why do we have to do this?
Yeah, absolutely. It's certainly not, it's not mandatory at all. I would say that the vast majority of parents, though, realize that these apps, screens, whatever it is your child is engaged in with a tablet or a phone, they are very compelling for children, and they are one way to snag a moment of rest. And so absolutely, you know, parents in the 80s and 90s, when they were on a long haul trip, they were probably suffering a lot more than parents today. And does that mean that we should just absolutely ban these devices? No, I don't think so. They can make our lives easier. Kids can find enjoyment. But I think the trick is that because they're so compelling, we just have to be really aware of the kind of balance that we're striking and recognize that it is often too easy to just open the floodgates and get out of balance because parents kind of want to stretch the amount of time that they're given to relax or get dishes done or email answered. And kids want to stretch the time that they can, you know, watch Bluey or Paw Patrol or whatever it is they're into.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think at this point before, because I was going to like get deeper into judging parents, but let me just back up and say that, you know, I think I have a screen addiction problem personally. And I don't use the phone in front of my kids. I'm fanatical about it because I want them to see a grown-up who doesn't have a phone in front of their face, which they don't get to see that often. And we enforce that rule with family members in the house too. But there's a part of me that feels a little bit hypocritical. Like, you know, I enjoy this and I actually use the phone to relax quite a bit in a way that feels unhealthy to me, but I can't seem to stop. And I went so far as for about 9 months last year, I used a light phone, which is like a, you probably know what it is, but it's a minimally functional phone. It basically can text and do phone calls. And it says it has directions, but they don't really work. and I used that for 9 months and it was fine. And I was able to use it and I switched back for really no reason. It just crept back into my life. And so I'm trying to avoid this fate for my children, but I think that maybe this is just in vain because they're going to end up, you know, modeling what I do rather than what I tell them to do.
Sure. Although it sounds like one thing that you're doing is not using your phone around them consciously, which I think is, you know, I try to do that as much as I can as well. I don't think I succeed to the degree it sounds like you are. But I think to bear in mind also that I actually don't see this as hypocritical at all because you're an adult and you have that metacognitive awareness of what you're doing and you can reflect on it. Whereas kids really, especially little kids, 3 and 4, don't really have that ability to reflect and say, what are the habits that I'm developing that are going to set me on this path through life? And these are the habits that, you know, the ways of being in the world right now that they're experiencing as a little kid will kind of set them up for whatever they do further on. And if they have this relationship to technology where they're not dependent on it and it's not the go-to source for entertainment, that hopefully will extend into the teen and 20s and beyond.
Is there data on, I mean, there can't be too much data on this because these things haven't existed for long enough.
No, there's not actually. And also existed for long enough, and longitudinal research like that is really hard to come by and it's hard to fund. And so, yeah, we have lots of correlational data, but in my first book, The App Generation, which is now 10 years old, we do talk about the importance, my co-author Howard Gardner and I, we talk about the importance of, you know, setting a stage for the habits that we develop early on in life. And they really will shape our approach to technology throughout our lives. So yeah, it's something that I think it's really important for parents to keep in mind is what sort of relationship to technology are they modeling for their children and also expecting of their children?
Man, what a way to be ahead of your time writing that book 10 years ago, which just for people who don't write books means you started it probably 13 years ago, or at least had that idea quite a bit before
you
published the book.
Yes. We started the research back in 2005, which was really interesting because, you know, Facebook was brand new and still, I think, only available on college campuses. YouTube had just come out. The iPhone was still a couple of years away. So yeah, it's been really fascinating. I've been doing this for almost 20 years now, and it's been really interesting watching the changes as we observe and talk to new waves of kids.
Yeah, I'll tell you my, I'm obviously not an expert, but what got me thinking about screen time was two things. One, I did a lot of work with AI, which we'll talk about in the next thing. And I went to some AI conferences and just realized that phones were primarily data collection devices for big corporations. So I wanted to participate in that consciously. Sometimes, you know, it's worth the trade-off. Like I think Google knowing where I am is worth the trade-off to me knowing where I am at all times. But But the thing that really put me over the top was just reading Steve Jobs talk about how he doesn't let his kids use any of the stuff he invents. And, you know, that was really all I needed to hear.
So many technologists do have stories like that. And so many of them in Silicon Valley send their kids to Waldorf schools and where there's no technology allowed. It's pretty interesting and telling.
That's so profoundly fucked up.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. So tell us about a concept that you go into in the book, good enough digital parenting.
Yes. Yeah, so now this is where I'm trying to go a little bit easy on parents with this concept of good enough digital parenting. And it starts with this observation that right now in the 21st century, 2023, there is a lot of pressure on parents, and not just when it comes to technology, just setting their kids up for success in life. There's, you know, making sure you're enrolling them in activities and that they're stimulated every minute of the day. And there's a name for this. It's called intensive parenting. And it's very different from how parents approached the whole enterprise of parenting in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Plus parents often, both parents, and it's a two-parent household, typically work full-time now. And there's just a lot for parents to do. So that's the backdrop of this concept of good enough digital parenting, is the idea that parents are frazzled. They're full of guilt, often, that they're not quite living up to all these expectations. So the idea of a good enough parent, so if we take away the digital part for a moment, it comes from a pediatrician, Donald Winnicott, who was writing in the mid-20th century. And so back then, he was really focused on the mother as the primary caregiver. So he coined this term, the good enough mother. And what Winnicott was arguing was that, in fact, if we're there for our children 100% of the time, we're doing them a disservice. And that's because they need room to solve their problems. They need room to figure out how to get unbored if they're bored. And if we're always there to hand them the next activity or to sort out their problems for them, they're not going to develop their own source of resilience. So I take that idea and I translate it into the digital context. And there are a number of ways that this manifests for good enough digital parenting. The first is that good enough digital parents are doing their best to steer their children towards high quality digital content. And sometimes, for instance, in your case, just keeping the digital content to a bare minimum or even keeping them away from it entirely, whatever feels right and works for parents. There, I can tell you as a researcher, there is no one right way to do this. There are better ways and less good ways, but good enough digital parents try to steer their children towards developmentally supportive experiences. They recognize that it's important to observe how their kids interact, because a one-size-fits-all approach to technology just doesn't work. So they observe, they pivot and adjust their approach as needed, as they're kind of like they're acting as scientists. They're collecting data on their kids and their reactions and adjusting as needed. And then also good enough digital parents look at their own technology use, and they are trying as best they can to model balance in their technology use, but recognizing that ultimately they're probably going to slip up. And when that happens, rather than just feel this overwhelming sense of guilt, to maybe use that as a teachable moment. And, you know, if for a young kid, you know, I do this a lot with Oliver. If I find that I'm focused on my phone, I'll say, you know what? I've just noticed I'm totally glued to my phone. Let me put that away and then we can get to back to what we were doing. For older kids, they might be able to, you could engage them in a conversation about, well, you know what? I'm really glued to my phone right now. I'm having a hard time putting it away. And you know what? That's by design. And you can even have a conversation about dark patterns. And so, yeah, good enough digital parents kind of give themselves a break, but also not just as an excuse to shirk their parenting responsibilities, but to channel that guilt, channel those slip-ups into teachable moments. And then I think really importantly, good enough digital parents recognize that it's not all on them to figure this out. They didn't create these challenges with technology. And I think right now in our very individualistic society, we have these companies who are creating all these technologies that are very, very compelling and difficult to put down. And then we're putting all of the onus on the kids and the parents to figure out how to manage this. And so I think that there's really a need for a broader societal effort. And that, I think, is where government regulation comes in and the tech companies being held accountable a little bit more than they are currently. But that's also another discussion.
No, that's an important discussion. And I think it's interesting to hear you. It's fascinating to hear you talk about this stuff. And one of the things that I'm noticing is, I don't know if this is a constitutional aversion to conflict or if you're just you're clearly brilliant and you know so much about this that you understand the nuances in a way that I don't, where I can just say don't give your kid the phone, end of story. And my feeling is put quite simply, and you could probably set me straight on this or send me one of your 70 academic papers that is about exactly this thing. But my feeling is that if you're, we don't know what the effect is into adulthood of giving kids this robust digital life that prevents them from ever feeling boredom or ever having to direct their own play. And maybe the effect is nothing. Maybe the effect is positive. Maybe the effect is catastrophic. But if you're allowing your kids unfettered access to phones, to mobile phones, and to touch screens, then you're making your kids part of the experiment rather than being part of the control.
Right. So I would definitely agree that giving your child unfettered access is something you want to not do. Unequivocally, don't do that. Mm. I think there's enough research out there that suggests that's really not going to be good for your children, especially, well, all children. But with young children, one of the key skills that they're developing is the ability to regulate their behavior and their emotion, this constellation of skills called executive function skills. Mm-hmm. And if they just always have a screen to go to whenever they're fussy or bored or tired, they're never going to have the space to develop those skills for themselves. And that's really not great because executive function sets kids up for all sorts of things like interpersonal success, academic success, even earning potential it's been associated with. So unfettered access is not good. But then, there is some complexity. And I definitely recognize what you're saying, that I do embrace the nuance here. And actually, that was one of the motivations for me to write this book was I have typically over the course of my career given very kind of it depends on the one hand, on the other hand kind of answers when people ask me at a cocktail party or at a family event. Well,
that's what experts do, because so much of the detail.
Yeah. So we go into it, we're kind of wishy-washy in that way. But then 6 years ago, I became a parent and I realized, oh, that's really not very helpful at all, saying it depends. And so in the book, although, I have to admit there's no research saying this is definitively good and this is definitively bad. In some areas, we can say that, I think, unfettered access, definitely bad. But I present a framework that you can apply to every stage of development to help you kind of use the complexity of the research to make concrete decisions for your particular context. And really, it comes down to asking yourself as a parent two questions when you're observing your kids' technology use or when you're trying to figure out, should I give them that tablet or should I let them watch this Pokemon show?
Pokemon is very...
Yeah.
Lucas is saying, no, you shouldn't.
No, you shouldn't. Okay. Yes.
Okay. Well, so but go ahead, Dr. Davis.
Or you can ask these two questions, which I ask myself every day. The first is this experience self-directed? And really that question is all about who's in control here? Is my child in control or is the technology that they're using in control? And so there could be examples of, a kid creating worlds in Minecraft or programming games in Roblox, where they're actually pretty in control and they're exercising some pretty sophisticated skills and creativity. And in that sense, yeah, I would say that that is a great example of a self-directed digital experience? So that's one important question. There's too many examples where it's not self-directed, where the child is just sort of looking like a zombie in front of a screen. You want to avoid those experiences as much as possible. The second question is really important for parents in particular, is it community supported? And so that is really all about what sort of supports are surrounding my child's technology use. So for my son, Oliver, most of that support comes in the form of me. So I'm the gatekeeper to what he has access to. If he is playing a game, well, he doesn't really play too many video games. I only let him play one, actually. And then Paw Patrol Rescue Run. And I do that. He can play it maybe once a month because I'm just very wary of how compelling video games can be for kids and how they can so easily co-opt their attention. So I'm introducing video games very slowly and deliberately. And I'm a little bit nervous about, you know, when he gets older and I hope he's not the kind of kid that is just totally glued to video games.
Did you have video games as a kid?
Yeah, I played Mario Brothers. I'll date myself. Not a ton. You know, I loved Mario Brothers. I could take it or leave it, though. You know, I could play for a couple of hours, but then never pick it up again for a couple of months. Whereas other kids are, you know, they get really, really into it, for better or for worse. And I think when it starts to encroach on other aspects of your life, then there's, you have to be a little bit worried about that. But in terms of the community support, you know, the monitoring is really important. Sometimes I try as much as I can to join in when I can with Oliver's technology use. There's a lot of research showing that this joint media engagement can actually be a great learning experience because parents get a sense of what their kids are doing, and then they can connect it to other parts of their lives. Mm-hmm. For older kids, sometimes that community support comes from the platform itself. So teens who are on social media, I talk about a site called Tumblr, which is a little bit more fringe, and it's often, you know, people of all ages, actually, who are into some aspect of fan culture or social justice issues. And I have, in my second book, actually, we interviewed a lot of youth who were very active on Tumblr, and they were finding a community on Tumblr to support their gender and sexual identity development and exploration. So there's lots of different ways to think about community support, but I would say going back to younger kids, it often will come down to the parents.
Yeah. I mean, I think about, I want to say this was chapter 4 in your book where you dove into this, but for younger kids with self-directed and community supported, I mean, if it's, I guess there aren't really that many games that are super self-directed for 2 to 4 year olds, because I don't know if they're capable of that kind of direction. And as far as community support, if you're supporting them, then you're losing the only scenario that you painted where these games might be useful, which is that you need a few minutes to unwind. But if you're like really engaged with them, you're not getting that. And so it's just another activity. It's an activity that you're doing with your kid. And I guess like the underlying narrative that I guess I just personally don't subscribe to, and it, maybe it just is because I love interacting with kids in this age group. I'm not anymore, but I used to be a preschool teacher. I coach my son's t-ball team, which is hands down the greatest thing I've ever done in my life. And I love interacting with my kids. And sometimes, like any parent, I don't want to. And I tell them that, and I, you know, tell them that I need some space. But it seems like the underlying narrative behind giving kids apps is that they're annoying and you don't want to deal with them. And that's just I just don't subscribe to that. I mean, like, yeah, your kids are going to be annoying. You knew this when you signed up for this. You know, it's part of being a parent.
Yeah, I can see that. So a couple of things. Sometimes you get parents who, for instance, are really into games themselves and genuinely enjoy playing games with their kids. I think that's, you know, maybe they enjoy it just as much, if not more, than playing t-ball. And I think that's a legitimate.
And that totally like falls into your paradigm here of self-directed and community supported. And I totally 100% agree with this part of the book. Like, I'm not into video games, but I have a good friend who is, and he's a mathematician and a professor and has an amazing young son who's about the same age as Oliver. And they do Roblox things together all day. But this is something that he loves to do. And so now his son loves to do it.
Right.
It's not my thing, so I don't do it with my kids, but Roblox, you name checked it. It's just a virtual universe that they can play with.
Right.
But he does it with them. It's totally supervised, and it's a thing, you know, instead of going fishing for whatever they can catch in Australia, they do Roblox.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, so I think an important thing to keep in mind is that the self-directed community supported framework is really, it's an ideal and a goal that you're striving towards, recognizing that not every experience is going to be equally self-directed or community supported. There are plenty of times where Oliver just sits on the couch in front of a TV and watches an episode of Paw Patrol. But I'm very conscious because I have this lens through which I'm evaluating his media experiences. And I'm saying, you know what? This is not the best experience, but for right now, in the context of this day, he's had a busy day. He's just been swimming and he's been at school all day. This is actually good for both of us. However, if it creeps into our reading time, then there's a problem. Then we're infringing on a really sacred part of our day. And I will never let that happen unless I'm sick. You know, that's different. So it's basically, you know, because I think often parents, what I hear both in my research and anecdotally from parents is that they're very confused and just they have a sense that there's screen time that's not good. And then some that might be okay because they're being encouraged to sign their kids up for Minecraft camps. And so, you know, they're not quite sure. And so this framework provides one way of making sense and saying, you know what, this particular experience is probably better than this experience because the kid is, you know, more in control. They're exerting their own agency and creativity versus just sort of sitting in front of a couch, in front of a TV for 5 or 6 hours. That's probably not what you want to do.
It's so interesting because I feel like my next question was going to be about technology and is technology like alcohol? But it sounds a little bit like what you're saying is that, you know, it sounds a little bit like, well, beer is better than liquor. But, you know, also not drinking is better than beer or liquor if you're talking about your health.
Well, yeah, I think that analogy breaks down, though, because I don't see, well, maybe there are health benefits for, I mean, sometimes I read that, you know, the news sometimes will show that there's health benefits to drinking a glass of wine or something like that. And I hope that that ends up being true because I like my wine in the evening. But
there are mental health benefits to drinking a glass of wine. That's for sure.
Okay. So yeah, I totally agree with you there. So maybe if we look at alcohol in terms of, perhaps there are mental health benefits, if not physical health benefits, then maybe the analogy holds. But I think, you know, it's not as clear whereas there are some digital experiences that are designed specifically to be educational and that actually kids are developing pretty sophisticated skills. And so, yeah.
The boring ones.
No, not necessarily. So Roblox, I think, is actually a really good example. Minecraft also. Oliver really likes right now going on YouTube and doing these drawing tutorials. And I know there's some artists have mixed feelings about that, but I think it provides a nice, you know, scaffold for him to learn how to draw. And so I think that there are more examples of good digital experiences than the alcohol analogy might suggest.
What I was going for, I derailed myself by wanting to jump in with this, but what I was the question was more about addiction. That, like, you know, I can have a glass of wine and move on with my life, but some people who I know cannot touch alcohol ever because they will spiral into. And is technology, and I feel like I might be a little bit that way with technology, where my wife, for example, can pull out her phone, do a thing, put it back, and not think about it. And, you know, I just get lost in it if I open it up. And my only recourse is to just, like, delete apps that monopolize my attention.
Yeah. So there are two really important points that are in that observation. And one is that people are different and some people are more susceptible to technology addiction than others. The term technology addiction is one that scholars fight about all the time, whether it's phone addiction or social media addiction. So or video game addiction. So I don't really come down one way or the other there, but because what I think is more important is how it's affecting you and if it's actually impeding on different aspects of your life. So different people are going to respond differently. The second point that's really important is that absolutely these devices and the platforms that run on them can be extremely hard to put down because they were designed by people with PhDs in addiction psychology and, you know, all of behavioral psychology. And they know exactly how to design these so that we keep staying on them. And so it's no wonder that we have such trouble putting these down. And it's not necessarily our fault. Again, it comes back, we have such an individualistic mindset in our society that same with obesity, you know, we have a certain setup in our society. But then if someone becomes obese, we blame the individual rather than that that surrounding context of their obesity. Same thing with technology.
Do you think that any of your research has been used to keep kids on platforms longer?
I don't think so, because I'm really not arguing for kids to stay on platforms longer. I'm warning about these dark patterns and the danger of staying on platforms too long. A lot of my research focuses on teens and their experiences on social media. And my research group right now, we're aware and have documented the many stresses that teens experience on social media. And so we're trying to come up with new designs for social media experiences to make them feel more intentional and more like you're in control of your experience. So yeah, I hope that my research isn't used. I don't have any reason to believe that it would be used to make that argument.
I also hope so. So great. We've learned a lot. I think your book is fantastic. I think any parent who's concerned about the digital life of their child and how to evaluate and be responsible with technology on behalf of your kid is going to want to read this book. We're going to talk next week about one of my favorite books, a book that we've covered on the podcast, one of my favorite books of last year, The Loop by Jacob Ward. And that was a Hachette book, 2022. We did an episode about it, which I'll link in this description with Jacob Ward, but I'm going to talk about it with Katie Davis, and we're going to hear about some of this stuff from a new perspective when we come back next week. The Book Society podcast is brought to you by me, Lucas Cantor Santiago, and produced by Chris Peters. We do new episodes on Fridays. We have a lot of episodes. You can listen to some back catalog. If you like the show, please give it a review. You can review it on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. Takes a few seconds. Helps out the show, helps other people find it, and we really appreciate it. All right, see you next week. I've been trying for half an hour and have failed to get you to tell me that people who allow kids to use screens while they're in restaurants are horrible parents. Unfortunately, you don't agree with me, and I'm not going to get you to give me your expert opinion that that's true.